Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Greg Daniel, Fellow and Managing Director here at the Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform at Brookings. And thank you for joining us for our continuing series of roundtable discussions on active medical product surveillance. Just as a quick background before we get started here, on January 31st, Brookings convened the 5th Annual Sentinel Initiative Public Workshop. It was an event which highlighted the progress and the future direction of the Sentinel Initiative. This meeting served as a public forum for stakeholders to ask and provide important input on the developments in Sentinel, and for those of you who are unable to attend the workshop, which was here in Washington, D.C., this webinar is an opportunity for you all to hear all the progress that has been made on Sentinel and to ask any questions and capture your feedback that you might have on the system. As many of you may know, Sentinel Initiative arose out of the result of the passage of the Food and Drug Administration Amendments Act of 2007. FDA mandated that FDA develop a system for post-market risk identification and analysis using existing electronic health data. Today, Sentinel's pilot project, which is called Mini Sentinel, is currently in its fourth year and has made tremendous progress over those last 4 years. Mini Sentinel has far surpassed the data access goals that were put forth by Congress in FDA and is well on its way to provide FDA with the necessary tools for a robust post-market safety surveillance system. You'll see from today's presentation just how valuable a tool Sentinel is to the FDA, and you'll see some examples of how it's being used to address a range of important safety questions. The success of Sentinel is largely due to FDA's leadership, but also due to the strong partnerships that have been forged between FDA, Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare, many academic institutions, and large payers that are serving as partners in this initiative. Before we begin, I'd like to just go over a few housekeeping issues. Today's webinar, I'd like to encourage you to submit questions throughout today's presentations. As the presentations are happening, you can submit your questions online at the Q&A tab at the top of your screen as you think of them, and they'll be put into queue. Once the presentations are finished, we'll reach out to you and ask you all to, in order of the queue, to ask your questions. Just as a reminder, please make sure that your microphone on your telephone is muted by either pressing the mute button or *6. In order to ask questions at the end of the presentations, please unmute your line by pressing *7. If at any time you experience any technical difficulties, please call the Level 3 Conferencing Center at 1-888-447-1119. So I'd like to move on to our presentations. Our presenters today are Patrick Archdeacon, a medical officer in the Office of Medical Policy within the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research at FDA, and Richard Platt, a professor and chair of the Department of Population Medicine at Harvard Medical School and the executive director of Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare Institute. I'd like to now hand things over to our presenters, Patrick and Rich. Patrick, are you on the line? So, Patrick, if you're on mute, you'll need to press *7 to unmute. So, Patrick, are you on the line?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you for being there.
Yeah, I wasn't on mute, but hitting *7 somehow worked again. Anyway, so I'm glad that we worked that out. So thanks, Greg. So FDA is very happy to have the opportunity to talk to this audience and recap a little bit the discussion that we had at the Brookings Public Workshop. We're also very excited to talk about our vision for the future of Sentinel. As Greg mentioned, it's been 5 years since the Sentinel Initiative was really launched in 2008. To date, Mini Sentinel has already supported more than 300 queries by FDA of its distributed database. And the information that we've gotten through Mini Sentinel is already complementing data that FDA receives through other sources and helping inform decision-making done at FDA. Obviously, the long-term goal is for FDA to make the best, most informed decisions possible, recognizing at the same time that many decisions are time-sensitive. So what I wanted to do with my time today was talk a little bit about the value that we feel that we're already getting from Mini Sentinel, And then to talk a little bit about a new capacity that we think is going to come online in June of this year that we're very excited about. And then to wrap up a little bit with our vision for what the future of Mini Sentinel is. See if I can advance. So Greg already, recapped for us. The genesis of Sentinel really came from the FIDA Act of 2007. He already talked about how we surpassed our goals in terms of patients. The real thing I wanted to highlight in this slide were the words identification and analysis. So those were really what we were mandated to do, was to have a tool that would help us with both analysis and also identification of post-market risks. So to talk a little bit about the value that we're getting from Mini Sentinel already and the achievements that we're getting from Mini Sentinel, I think it's fair to say that Mini Sentinel has already done an excellent job of helping us collect and analyze data to test some existing hypotheses. And there's a couple different approaches that Mini Sentinel has that allows us to do this. So one of them are sort of our more resource-intensive protocol-based studies. Those take approaches that are not so dissimilar from other epidemiology studies that have been done in the past. And sort of the newer thing are these modular programs that allow us to have quick one-time assessments of associations between products and health outcomes of interest. I think Dr. Platt is going to follow me, is going to do a little bit of a deeper dive on each of these. But I'll just say, for instance, some of the protocol-based assessments that we thought were particularly interesting and valuable. Mini Sentinel was able to look for evidence of an association between different drugs that affect the renin-angiotensin system and the outcome of angioedema. Was able to perform a similar analysis looking for an association between Gardasil and thromboembolism. Using the modular programs, they were able to take a quick look to see if there was any data that would support evidence of an association between dabigatran using a comparator of warfarin and outcomes like GI bleeding and intracerebral hemorrhage. That last one that I cited, the modular program with dabigatran, actually gave FDA some data that contributed to an important drug safety communication related to this. So at present, to summarize, the Mini Sentinel infrastructure we think is very good at capturing data about product exposures, particularly product exposures that happen in the outpatient setting. We've developed some important experiences looking at a handful of outcomes that we think we're now able to do fairly reliably. And some of those important examples would include myocardial infarction, bleeding, anaphylaxis. The programming exists, or the capability exists, to create programs that will look for associations between products and these particular outcomes. So what we really have right now is a sort of a highly specialized system that is allowing us to look at a restricted range of outcomes and either do so in a way that is very resource-intensive and time-intensive, or that is quick but is susceptible to some systemic biases and confounding issues. So our goals going forward are really twofold. Is one, we'd like to increase these current capabilities because we do think they are very important and valuable. But also we're very excited about a new capability that we anticipate coming online this summer, which is the introduction of what we call semi-automated routine surveillance capability. So with this, we anticipate not simply being able to evaluate whether or not a specific association that we suspect may be there, but to instead look at a range of health outcomes of interest for a range of products in a sequential method to see, as the data comes in, is there any evidence of an association that perhaps we didn't suspect in the previously. So, like I said, this will be our first iteration of this system we hope to have online by June 2013. Obviously, we expect that this system will become refined and improved in the ensuing years. But let's talk a little bit about the features that we think will be present from the get-go. So we think we're going to have a fairly large menu of health outcomes of interest that we'll be able to look for. For any given product, we probably would not look for all the HOIs that we'll have algorithms programmed for, but a subset that we think are relevant. In a later slide, I'll disclose some of the HOIs that we're currently creating algorithms for. We think this first generation system will have the ability to look for these associations between medical products that include drugs, biologics, and vaccines, and the health outcomes of interest. probably in this first system, we're not going to have a capability to look for associations with devices in HOI pairs due to the difficulty of capturing data related to device exposures at this time. Obviously, we'll have to continue to develop some methodologies and data use policies as we refine this, but we do think we're going to have the ability to replicate at least three different important epidemiology methodologies in this first generation system. I'll touch on that again a little bit later. So the focus of this first system is really, let's try to go back. I lost the middle slide, but there's, I think, a signal generation. So I guess the idea being that we're not really doing a data mining exercise here, and we're not really doing a signal evaluation with this semi-automated routine surveillance. Instead, we're living in sort of a middle ground where we think that there could be health outcomes of interest that would be plausibly related to a product, maybe because of a class of drug, or maybe because of the mechanism of drug action, or maybe simply because all drugs have historically been associated some fraction of drugs have been associated with these types of outcomes. An example of that might include something like severe acute liver injury or anaphylaxis, where there's always some level of suspicion. So what are the activities that we need to do in order to get this semi-automated system up and off the ground? So one, we're going to have to establish algorithms that are capable of identifying these relevant HOIs. As I mentioned, we right now have algorithms in hand to look at a handful of things like acute myocardial infarction, anaphylaxis, GI bleeding. We really need to expand that much more broadly in order to have a system that's going to have the range that we'd like to have. Some of the modules that will be incorporated into the modular program will also require that we have the ability to capture data related to confounders and cohorts, so we're developing algorithms related to that as well. As I implied, we're building new modules, really computer programs, that can be inserted into our existing modular programs that will allow those modular programs to replicate some basic features of epidemiology study design. And, of course, we really need to think very hard about what our data use strategies are with regards to sequential analysis and data reuse if we're going to apply these tools properly. So here's a list of the HOIs that we've prioritized for development for this routine surveillance system. These came from a couple of different sources. We considered first what outcomes in the past have been associated with drug safety signals and with product withdrawals. We also considered issues like mechanisms of action. We also considered whether or not these outcomes would really be feasible to study through an epidemiology study design. So in any case, we anticipate that this list will continue to expand, but these are the ones that we prioritize at the beginning. Similarly, we have a list of algorithms related to particular patient cohorts that we think might be important to study within the context of the system. I mentioned that there were going to be new modules coming online this summer that would be inserted into the modular programs, and each of these modules would attempt to replicate important epidemiology study designs. So the three modules, one of them replicates essentially a self-controlled case series approach. The other two are more in the vein of cohort studies. One of them is essentially emulating a propensity score-based approach. The other one uses a regression analysis technique. So as I mentioned, in addition to simply building these tools, I think there's a lot of thinking that goes into how to most appropriately apply them. So we need to develop an operations manual that's going to help our users determine which of the modules are most appropriate to use. We have something called a taxonomy framework that we're developing that will help with that. Certainly, we need to think about the questions of how to best perform sequential analyses as the data continues to accumulate, and thinking about what types of data we'd like to use, the freshest possible data, or do we want to allow for there to be a little bit of time in order to have the highest quality data possible. I'll just summarize a little bit again the difference between the capabilities that we have currently and some of the capabilities that we're considering. Certainly with the modular programs, we do have an ability to do less resource intensive and rapid studies now, but those are somewhat potentially confounded. So comparing the protocol-based approach and the semi-automated approach, certainly we think that this will be less resource intensive. We concede that we will not always have the same ability to control systemic biases as we do currently through these resource-intensive protocol-based approaches. However, we do think that may be okay as long as you understand the limits of the data that you're getting and the information that you're getting when you use this approach. And if we use a semi-automated approach to generate hypotheses, there's nothing preventing us from going forward and doing a more sophisticated protocol-based study to help us test an hypothesis that we generate. The last thing that I wanted to touch on with the time that I have left was a slide that Dr. Janet Woodcock put up, sort of describing her vision for the Sentinel Initiative. As Greg mentioned, the original Mini-Sentinel contract was a five-year contract that was issued in September of 2009. That expires in September 2014, which is a little bit off, but probably sooner than it feels to some people, and I suspect other people are feeling very close already. Certainly we at FDA are thinking a lot about how to best support this investment. We feel like it's been a huge benefit to us, and we want to make sure that we continue to have it available to us, and we think its value is only going to grow in the coming years. So our number one priority is really maintaining our current ability, our current capacity, and for that reason, we think the next logical step is to award another five-year contract to support the Sentinel Operations Center. That we think is going to be the main way forward in terms of preserving the significant gains that we already have had. In addition, Dr. Woodcock talked a lot about her vision for building a national resource data infrastructure. So we think that the primary purpose for FDA of Mini-Sentinel and for Sentinel is to conduct this very important safety surveillance. That said, we understand that it's a tool that could have other applications. So we're very much open to the idea that this could be turned into a national data infrastructure that others could access as well. So we're certainly considering the possibility of creating some cooperative agreements that would help us build towards that. Obviously we're in uncertain economic and budgetary times, so our primary focus at this point remains on the five-year contract. But that is a larger vision that has been presented and discussed as well, this idea of a cooperative agreement that would both allow others access to these important data infrastructure as well as help develop some methods to better understand how it could be applied. So with that said, I think I'll turn it over to Dr. Platt.
Okay. Thanks, Patrick. Sorry, go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, okay. Voice check is okay?
Great.
Sounds great.
Okay, thanks. Well, it's really a pleasure to be able to talk with you today. The message of the first 2 years of the Mini-Sentinel was watch this space. We're making great progress. And I think the message of year three is that we turned the corner to be able to start providing information to FDA that supports its regulatory mission, and that's been a source of real a sort of a sense of accomplishment and pride, and to be perfectly honest, a sense of relief for those of us who were charged with using the taxpayers' money wisely to sort of deliver on a promise that we had made collectively to FDA. Patrick really covered the basic mandate and the instruction to us to do essentially four things: develop the capacity for medical product safety evaluation, to develop and evaluate a variety of scientific methods, and then actually to evaluate some safety issues and be attentive to the lessons learned about where there are problems and challenges and to be thoughtful about how to address them. The Mini-Sentinel is comprised of these 2.5 dozen organizations, and 400 investigators based in one of these investigations. And the successes we've had have really been attributable to this large number of investigators working as a team with FDA to be able to think of ways to use a variety of resources that were created for other purposes, for the delivery of care, for administrative and billing purposes, and to harness them for the safety evaluations that FDA is interested in. The heart of our technical capabilities live with a distributed data system that's shown in cartoon version in this slide. The important organizational features to take from this are that each of the data partners, we show two here, there are actually 17 of them, each of them maintains control over all of its own data, and that has the enormous advantage that there's no need to move patients' confidential information outside of the organization that already has it in almost every circumstance. And that means that FDA has the capability to ask questions, which the operations center shown at the top converts into an executable program. We use SAS and SQL to distribute those programs. Each data partner can review those programs and execute them. The reason they can execute them is they have transformed their data into a common data model, and then they can review the results and return them to the operations center. So what comes back in the vast majority of situations is aggregate data, and that aggregate data from the 17 data partners is then aggregated to provide an overall set of answers for FDA. We've tried to be attentive to emerging national standards, and the network communications are all built to be Query Health compliant. Query Health is the major initiative of the Office of the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology. And this has meant that the Mini Sentinel has actually emerged as one of the ONC demonstration projects for the development of a learning health system. Patrick mentioned that Mini Sentinel data had been used as the basis of a drug safety communication for describing bleeding associated with dabigatran, and this is a screenshot of that communication. That's an example of the use of our modular programs, which I'll talk about a little more detail later. And Patrick also mentioned protocol-driven studies. And this is an example of a protocol-driven study that was reported both as a report on our website and as a peer review publication. This is in the Archives of Internal Medicine. We were delighted that when the Archives published it, the editors accompanied it with an editorial that said, "This is a good idea. We commend the Food and Drug Administration for developing the Mini Sentinel." So we are fully cognizant of the fact that our 100% obligation is to FDA to support its regulatory work, but we see an additional kind of validation and confirmation of the quality of the work in being able also to have it pass muster for peer review and have this kind of commentary. I'll spend the next few minutes describing the six kinds of activities that the Mini Sentinel investigators are attentive to essentially on an every week basis. There are parallel streams of activity that are going on at almost all the time. The first of these is developing and maintaining this distributed data set, which is a core resource that we have built. The reason that there is so much ongoing work is that the data are refreshed about four times a year. So there are 17 data partners. Each of them refreshes this data multiple times per year. And that refreshing work um, occurs a great deal of quality checking. Each refresh engenders a check of about 400 different parameters, and they require about 100 data partners per refresh. This is an example of what four of those look like. And so there are several people whose full-time job is to be working with data partners around those the updating of the data set and ensuring that the data are available for FDA to use with reasonable assurance that we know that the data pass basic quality standards. The distributed data set currently has close to 400 million person years of quality check time, during which we know that individuals have both pharmacy and medical coverage, and so we have reasonable confidence that most medically attended events will be ascertainable. That's important because we want to have reasonable confidence that if we don't see an event, that it probably didn't occur, and it's not just a question of having spotty coverage of events. We also have the same kind of reasonable confidence about medications dispensed in the ambulatory setting and about other medical treatments for which we should be able to find a CPT or HCPCS code. Having a data set available, a data resource that can be queried, there are effectively two ways to query it, and I'll spend a minute talking about the modular programs that we use. Modular programs are basically reusable programs that are intended to address questions of a type that FDA asks frequently. So a very common request from FDA is of the form between some year, which we'll call the start date, and some other year, which we'll call the end date. That's usually the most recent data you have. Find everyone who has started a new treatment episode with some treatment, and we want you to define new as first episode in at least a certain number of days. Maybe it's a year. We want to be sure that there's at least a year preceding this first treatment when we know that the person hasn't been receiving the same treatment. And we want to be able to either include people who have a certain condition or exclude people who've had a certain condition. As I say, we want people who have a first treatment with drug A, and we also want to be able to exclude people who've been treated with not only with drug A before that, but people who've been treated with drugs B and C or who've had specific kinds of diagnoses. And then we want you to look ahead for outcomes that occur while the person's being treated or for a certain number of days after that treatment has begun. And we want the option to say ignore the first X number of days. And sometimes we want to look beyond the end of treatment for some period of time. So that's a very standard kind of question. And so we've built a program that accepts those kinds of inputs as parameters that can be chosen. And that's the way that the Bigetran analysis was done, using modular programs. So there's not a lot of flexibility. And at present, there's not a lot of ability to adjust for confounding. But the trade-off means that in a relatively short period, we can give back an answer that everybody can trust is doing what we expect it to do. The use of those of modular programs, there are seven of them now, is picking up pace. Patrick mentioned that we've executed over 300 queries for FDA. But frequently, it's important to run more than one modular program or to execute the same modular program in a variety of different ways to answer a single query. And so the actual traffic back and forth between the coordinating center and the data partners is, as of the end of December, was 1,400 of those programs that were distributed and executed and returned and then synthesized to support the FDA queries. As Patrick mentioned, sometimes modular programs aren't enough, and in that case, we develop a protocol to be able to have the flexibility that we need. And this example of products of antihypertensives that target the renin angiotensin aldosterone system and the relationship to angioedema is sort of a good worked example. And part of our goal in doing that particular project was to answer a question of regulatory importance to FDA, but also to develop the capacity to do these kinds of studies. So goal one was assess these events, and goal two was to build out general strategies for safety assessments when there's already a substantial amount of accumulated experience. This wasn't designed to be a full epidemiologic study that would lead to a definitive evidence of a causal relationship. But the basic drill for a protocol-based assessment starts, as always, with FDA identifying a topic that's important to it. The Operations Center issues a work group opportunity, and the work group is populated from the 400 investigators. We identify a leader who has methodologic and content expertise, and the rest of the work group brings different kinds of skills. That work group, which always includes FDA staff, develops a protocol. The draft protocol is posted on the MiniSentinel website for 2 weeks, and we invite public comment, and then a final version is posted. Work group does the protocol and prepares a final report and posts it on the website. And sometimes they may also be published in the peer review literature. So here's what happened with that study. It used the data set as of July 2011 when there were about 100 million people. After applying a variety of eligibility rules, there were four cohorts of new users of the product shown here. And you see that it was possible to identify a substantial number of new users for ACE inhibitors, angiotensin receptor blockers, about 5,000 for aliskiren, which was the newest agent as of 2011. And the one that was, frankly, of greatest interest to FDA, and the beta blockers were chosen as a reference group because there was no there was no expectation that beta blockers were associated with angioedema. Because this is a distributed system, and we put a high priority on not transferring patient level data. We used a propensity score matching approach, which condenses a great deal of information about individuals into a single non-identifiable measure. And then we used a case-centered approach and meta-analysis that meant that all that was needed to be transferred to support this analysis was aggregate data. The study began in March of 2011, and it ended 11 months later. For those who do these kinds of studies, that's extraordinarily fast. And so this is one of the values of having a well characterized data set and individuals who were skilled in knowing how to use it to best advantage. And the results were pretty satisfying. You can see in the left-hand panel, the red triangle, that the evaluation reproduced the previously well-described association between ACE inhibitors and angioedema. But the confidence intervals and the best literature estimate is shown in green. But because of the size of the cohort, the confidence intervals are much narrower. So this, on the one hand, replicates a known finding, and on the other hand, gives us a lot more precision. It shows that there's a modest but much smaller association between angiotensin receptor blockers and angioedema. And although the confidence intervals for aliskiren are wide, aliskiren at that point in time looked much more like ACE inhibitors than like ARBs with regard to its relationship to angioedema. So our takeaways are, first of all, it's substantially the largest assessment of this topic. We were pleased to see that we replicated known data, and we provided new data about both of the other classes of agents. And we now believe that we have a time and cost-efficient process for doing these kinds of analyses. And in part, that's because we were able to adapt analytic strategies that provide pretty robust robust analyses without sharing identifiable information. Now, this is a study that did not use that did not review medical records because there was already a literature saying that a diagnosis of angioedema is pretty trustworthy. So we didn't feel that it was necessary to do that. But there are a number of the outcomes that Patrick listed are ones for which the coded information in medical records isn't sufficiently accurate for us to trust that. So MiniSentinel has the ability to obtain full text records when that's important. The way in which we do that is to have the data partners who are already in possession of protected health information for these individuals obtain the relevant sections of the records. They redact identifying information, and then they forward the de-identified material to an expert adjudicating panel. And then that panel applies standard definitions to assess the whether or not the individual experienced the event of interest. I'll just describe briefly a study that's in progress that is using medical record review as part of its drill. And that is an evaluation of rotavirus vaccines and intussusception. There, many of you will know that the first rotavirus vaccine was voluntarily withdrawn from the market because there were between 1 and 2 cases of intussusception for 10,000 vaccine recipients. There are two new vaccines that are currently on the market. Both of them were marketed after clinical trials that evaluated at least 60,000 infants, which is large enough to exclude excess risks of the size seen with the original vaccine, but don't exclude measurable excess risks of intussusception. So this is a study that's, as I said, is in progress now. It's looking at over 1 million doses of the pentavalent vaccine, Rotatec, and about 100,000 of doses of the monovalent vaccine, Rotarix, which is the reason there are fewer is it's used less in, by these organizations. What I wanted to show you is that we identified 340 potential cases because there was a coded diagnosis that corresponds to intussusception. We obtained close to 80% of those medical records for expert adjudication and confirmed intussusception, the intussusception diagnosis, in about half of the cases where we were able to obtain a chart. And so the analysis, the principal analysis, focuses on these 124 cases. I want to make sure to point out that these cases come from the entire infant population, including infants who were never exposed to rotavirus vaccine, and all of the time accrued for these infants, even when they weren't in a risk window when they would have been at risk for vaccine-induced disease. But the reason for showing this is to demonstrate that when it's important to obtain medical records, it's possible to do that. There are a number of protocols, protocol-based evaluations that are in the field now. I've listed some of them here. I'll just mention that the second one, the impact of labeling changes, is looking not at an exposure outcome relationship, but at the impact of regulatory action on the use of a product. And we think that's one of the additional values that MiniSentinel provides to FDA, this ability to use time series analysis to assess the consequences of regulatory action. And I've listed here the protocol-based assessments that are under development. I won't linger on this because I know the slides have been distributed and are available to all of you. The fourth thing that we do is methods development and implementation. Our goal principally is not to do sort of a deep scientific dive on methods, but to look at adapting methods that have been demonstrated to be useful to MiniSentinel's purposes. I've listed here four of the methods development activities that are underway, and I'll just spend another minute talking about the prospective surveillance work that Patrick already introduced. The notion here is that when there is a newly marketed product, it will be important to define the exposures and the outcomes that are important for this product. So by defining exposures, which populations in particular are we most concerned about, and which durations of exposures or what settings of exposures do we care about? Patrick was very clear about the range of kinds of outcomes that we want. It's important to choose an analysis approach to estimate the risk, aggregate those results. Every time we update the assessment to ask, is there sufficient evidence of a potential problem that needs to be thought about as a specific activity? In any event, we report that to FDA, and then FDA decides when the information that comes from this kind of sequential analysis is important to communicate to the public. You can see the arrow there sort of loops back to if the alerting rules say there's nothing important here, we go back to re-estimating the risk every time a data partner updates its data. I'm going to skip over these next two slides because Patrick did a nice job of describing the fact that we're going to start off with three different ways to estimate the risk, and that which we choose will depend on partly on the product and partly on the way it's used and partly on the outcomes that are of interest. We're putting a reasonable amount of time into developing new capacity. The four things that are on our agenda for this year are this prospective surveillance work that Patrick described and we just looked at. Secondly, to develop new query tools. The toolkit that we have now is proving to be useful, but there are lots of things that we know we could do better or more quickly if we had more tools, and so we're building those. For instance, we're working on a next generation modular program that will automatically do high dimensional propensity score adjustment if FDA decides that it needs that information as part of the query. We're building out our bandwidth to be able to respond to more queries. At the moment, the people who are doing this work are running pretty fast to keep up with FDA, and we want to be able to be as responsive to FDA as FDA needs us to be. And we're working on new data. The particular things that are of interest at the moment are linking the data that the data partners have now to state birth and immunization registries. We're exploring the potential to do more with inpatient data, which is not an entire black box at the moment, but for which we have much less detailed data than we do on the ambulatory side. And the final thing that we're doing is trying to be attentive to FDA's interest in developing a national resource. We have active engagement with these seven organizations. Observational Medical Outcomes Partnership is a good partner with us in thinking about how to apply the things that they have learned to the work that we're doing for FDA. We're actively engaged with the NIH Healthcare System Research Collaboratory, the other organizations and initiatives shown here. I'll take just a minute to say that the notion of being able to make available for other uses the distributed data set that's been created by FDA is going to have its sort of first public face in the NIH Distributed Research Network, which we are building as part of the NIH Healthcare Systems Research Collaboratory. The distributed network will have the ability to interface with potentially a large number of organizations, including all of the organizations that participate in MiniSentinel. I want to be clear that the MiniSentinel data partners have not agreed simply to make their data available. Some of them have agreed to be partner organizations with the Distributed Research Network, and others are thinking about it. But the technical capability is there so that when they are interested in partnering with NIH, it'll be possible to use all of the capabilities that MiniSentinel has built to enable that. The schematic looks something like this. If these are organizations that are part of the FDA MiniSentinel, the NIH would have the ability to partner with all of those organizations that want to participate. I've shown here that three of them would, but also to engage other organizations to participate in that network. And the extrapolation is some other network could be created that's also able to use the resources that are built by these organizations. So the partner organizations have the ability to choose to participate in one or two or more of these networks if they want to. And the networks will be able to leverage data resources that have already been built and the query tools and the program libraries and the system knowledge. So we see this as a flexible way to be able to reuse the products of these investments without requiring upfront commitments from organizations and providing a great deal of autonomy to organizations that have data. So I'll wrap up by saying, in my view, there are a number of important contributors to the progress that we've made so far. The most important of those is the fact that we have been able to develop a very strong partnership that involves FDA personnel, data partners, content experts, epidemiologists, and statisticians. And there's just no substituting for this kind of close coordination between people who share a common goal and bring different kinds of skills and expertise and resources to support that common mission. I think I speak for just about all 400 of the investigators who feel that this has been a very positive activity that although it's structured as a contract and we have deliverables and we work hard to meet them, the sense that FDA has really imparted is that this is a partnership. So FDA doesn't treat us as vendors, and the investigators don't behave as though they as though they are in that regard. Building the system on a distributed data network has been a critical feature in letting us make progress. I'm reasonably sure that if we had tried to build this as a centralized database, that we'd still be talking about the terms and conditions under which the data would be exchanged. The third thing that has made a big difference is this whole activity is being conducted under FDA's Public Health Authority, and that has made a big difference. For instance, when we request medical records, to say we are doing this as a public health activity at the request of the Food and Drug Administration. The fourth is the fact that we have focused on defined populations with reasonably complete data. As we see that as the bedrock, and so. When that's the premise, when that's the foundation, it means you start with claims and administrative data where there is access to full text records, even if it takes a lot of work to get each record. And then we're adding electronic data on top of that as it's available and it's possible. The fifth thing that we've done is to always ask what can we build relatively quickly that will be useful, while being thoughtful about what the enhancements would be. We've used that rapid cycle approach to good effect, because in the process of building these things, we've learned a lot about what works, what doesn't work, and which kinds of enhancements really will make sense. The contrast would be write a very detailed description of everything that FDA needs and then try to build it. And that would be a longer process that would take us, we're pretty sure, down long dead blind alleys, and we'd have to turn around and back that up. And I think this may be the last of the things is having built the ability to respond quickly to predefined needs. That is saying, that's what the modular programs do. We will have these kinds of needs on a recurring basis, and so we wanted to be able to create the capability to respond to those needs in a rapid way. I'll say a few words about how much does all this cost and what do we get for it. FDA invests about $10 million a year in maintaining the distributed database and the capability to do hundreds of these rapid response queries that use modular programs. So because of the heavy lift that's involved in doing it, there isn't a good way to have quality data at your fingertips without putting this kind of investment into it. That has the effect of meaning that the protocol-based studies are much less expensive than they would otherwise be. That the angioedema study that Patrick and I both described cost less than $250,000. For those of you who do this kind of work, you would recognize that ordinarily it would cost about 10 times this much. And ordinarily it would have taken 2.5 or 3 times the amount of time. So the marginal cost of doing these studies is much lower. We are also in a much better position to respond to something like an H1N1 influenza pandemic, and to be able to look at the safety of a novel vaccine than we have ever been before. One of the things that we learned, because the H1N1 pandemic occurred before mini sentinel existed, and we were involved in trying to stand up a surveillance system quickly to deal with that, and it was effectively impossible. We worked very hard, and we did contribute some useful information several months after the vaccine was introduced, and so we learned from that you can't build a system like that quickly enough to be useful, no matter what resources you're prepared to put into it. And FDA is now in a position where it will be able to do things like monitor vaccine safety pretty quickly. So this information and others is on the MiniSentinel website, and I'd be consider it a great favor if you would look at the website and give us some feedback about it. I've put a red oval around the RSS feed link. You can sign up to subscribe to be notified about all the updates to the website. It's the best way to keep up to date about the Mini Sentinel. So thanks very much for giving me the opportunity.
All right, great. Thanks, Rich and Patrick, for those great presentations. We got about 2 minutes left now or maybe a few more than that, for some questions. Just to remind everybody, if you do have questions, please use the Q&A tab at the top of your screen. Type your question in there, and then that'll get you in the queue, and we'll call on you to read those questions. So the first question that we have, I'd like to turn to Angelica. Angelica, if you're on the line, can you go ahead and press *7 to unmute and then read your question?
Sure, I'm here. I actually have two questions. The first question was whether the prospective surveillance tool would apply to all newly marketed products. And the second question was if you believe the capabilities of Sentinel will affect the need for sponsors to conduct observational studies as part of a post-marketing requirement, or if this would kind of change things in the future.
So let me tackle the first question. As I understand it, was, would prospective surveillance be applied to all products? I think we have a vision in the future that we would like to have such a system. In June of 2013, we anticipate starting by selecting one or two products to be our first pilot product. Jeff Brown at the Mini Sentinel Operating Center likes to refer to this as sort of our hand-cranking phase. So we're going to be learning a lot in those first couple of products. I anticipate that, you know, over the course of months and years, we'll build up our capabilities, both in terms of our ability to interrogate the data and also our confidence in the system, and ultimately we'll expand to doing, if not all products, then all newly marketed products. That may be a ways off yet, though. With regards to the impact on what sponsors' obligations will be for post-marketing studies, I think that's certainly a evolving area. We would like to see this system become an infrastructure that various people would have access to, including industry. Obviously, we're not there yet, but it is a tool that FDA will have access to. And so we think that there's opportunities, at least, that we may be able to collaborate to facilitate certain types of research that might meet the needs of some post-marketing obligations. So I think it's one tool. I would look at it as a tool to add on to existing ways to respond, as opposed to a new obligation that people will be burdened with. That would be my view of it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, great. So we are just about finished. I do want to ask one question before we end, and this might go to both Patrick and Rich, but any comments that you might want to make on any planned expansion of the common data model or any enhancements, Rich, you did have on one of your slides, like a next step might be to bring in more electronic health record data. Any further comments you want to make on that, on any progress or initiatives that you have going?
Rich, do you want to take that?
Sure. Next up is expanding it to include the ability to link mothers and infants so that we'd be able to look at the neonatal outcomes of prenatal exposures. So that's where I think we'll head next. Depending on the what we learn about the availability of inpatient data, we may the thing we might do after that is focus on the inpatient side.
Okay, great. Thanks for that, Rich. So I would like to thank both Patrick and Rich for your presentations today, and I'd also like to thank everyone who tuned in for today's webinar. Presentation materials, including the audio, will be posted to the Brookings website in the next few days. And thanks again, everybody, for participating this afternoon, and enjoy the rest of your day.